Hello and welcome to our latest episode of The Wagon, with me, Finty Williams, and my friend and psychotherapist, John McEwan.
Hello.
Before we start, we want to say thank you to Ibiza Calm, who has made this entire series possible. Ibiza Calm is a residential clinic specialising in addictions and mental health, and we are eternally grateful to them. This week, we are extremely lucky to be joined by the model, presenter, and star of Strictly, and from everything that I've heard and read, extremely fine person, Daisy Lowe.
Oh, thank you. That is very sweet. Bless you. I'm very honoured to be here, and I too am eternally grateful to this man, John, and Ibiza Calm, because without everyone that makes Ibiza Calm as incredible as it is, I probably wouldn't be here today.
Well, we're very pleased that you are here.
Thank you.
It's great, and thank you. And I believe it's the first time you've really gone in any depth in terms of your own psychology and what happened to you in that time you had, which I'd describe as burnout, actually. I'd probably describe that as and that's a phrase and term lots of people use these days without really knowing what it is. Mm. It's an awful condition and affliction, and I'm not pinning that on you as such, but I think what you went through was a really difficult time. And should we start with the darker stuff?
Should we start with the darker stuff and then get to the lighter stuff?
Yeah. I mean, that time, I happened to see you once or twice and you weren't well. You weren't well. It was you and Monty.
Me and Monty.
And the apartment, the house. And that was it, from what I remember.
Yeah, I think my world became very, very, very small, because that's all I could really cope with. I think if I go back kind of to the year before, the year leading up to that moment, mm-hmm. where I actually finally got brought to your door kicking and screaming, I had done Strictly Come Dancing, which was the greatest experience I'd ever done in my professional career, certainly, because I knew what I was doing for 6 months straight, which as a self-employed person, that was the dream. I knew exactly my schedule. I like schedules. I like knowing where I'm going to be every day. And I also got to dance every day. I was literally, my job was to learn how to dance, and it was so joyful and, so full of light, but it's obviously incredibly high octane. And coupled with that, my favorite person in the entire world passed away on my very first day. So my grandfather died as I was being introduced to everyone that was part of the kind of Strictly family. And I got the call that day, and I had to make the choice. You know, I actually wanted to walk out and quit day one, hoping to come back another time after I'd grieved. And my grandmother called me and she said, "Don't you dare go and win this for him." And obviously I didn't win it, but I did have a wonderful time. And I think the pressure of getting kicked out after 8 weeks, when I thought I could go all the way to 12 or 13, was heartbreaking. So like, I'd failed him and his memory, and I wanted to do it for him because he was an amazing ballroom dancer. And which I actually didn't find out until he was gone and I was on the show, which was so heartbreaking. But after doing Strictly, obviously, you know, it then inspires lots of people to think, oh, she's on the telly at the minute. She's cool. Let's get her involved. And so I was working around the clock. I bought a house. I also decided at that moment when Strictly was over that, you know, I had to love what I do every day, and to be starved of that felt so heartbreaking. Mm. When it all finished, that bubble was well and truly burst, and I was feeling pretty low, to be, you know, no pun intended. And I thought, how can I do what I love every day? How can I make this happen? So I set up a production company and started my own podcast, where I was interviewing women that I found really inspiring. And actually, weirdly, was, you know, the main topic of conversation was actually a lot about mental health, but I had no idea what my own brain had in store for me. Mm. And so I think I set up my production company and bought a house in the same week. And this was all 6 months after my gramps had passed. And I was working kind of between 5 and 8 jobs a day, potentially. Because it was that thing of, you know, strike while the iron's hot. I've definitely got that like self-employed model brain of, you know, grab at it at that time. And I knew I wanted a kitchen extension and I knew I wanted this and that and I wanted to make my house amazing and I wanted to pay off my mortgage faster than I had originally planned. You know, it was all those things of those big dreams. And also I think another big thing, you know, I was 28 at the time and I thought that really I'd be buying a home with someone. I think maybe in the back of my mind that might have also been part of it, that I thought, oh, wow, okay, I'm really doing this on my own and I'm doing this even more on my own because my gramps isn't here to kind of hold my hand. And I had no idea how much I was struggling and I was really clutching at straws. So it hit. So from kind of September to December, I didn't stop. And I was frightening myself because I was having heart palpitations and I was quite shaky and I was talking very quickly. And it got to the end of December and I got to Christmas and I just broke. And I noticed it over the Christmas period that rather than enjoying Christmas holidays and parties or trying to be social and wanting to be around my friends, even for things like New Year's, and I just didn't want to see anyone. And I remember calling one of my best friends, who is incredible and is still a very firm part of my support network. And I just remember saying, yeah, I just don't know what's wrong with me. I'm using any excuse to just not see anyone. And I don't know what that's about because I've never been like that.
I was going to say that was new for you then, obviously.
Really new. Mm. And obviously, you know, going through the whole thing, I now know it's really important to have time on your own. I really love my own space, but this was very different. This then led to crippling agoraphobia that I, you know, then didn't really leave the house for about six or seven months. Wow. And I couldn't. The strangest thing happened that I think I was so burnt out that I lost the ability to speak. Like my kind of vocabulary was so limited and all I could really say were things like, I'm sad or I'm scared or I feel really anxious, but it was so, or I went to my mum's, it was so basic. And I'm a really chatty, like I'm a big fan of a chat. So I love having a good old heartfelt conversation. And actually to lose my vernacular was so frightening. Yeah. And I think every single day I'd wake up thinking, today's going to be different, surely. Like I have to feel different. By tomorrow I'll feel okay, and tomorrow I'll feel okay. And I kept just expecting. And eventually I was like, God, is this going to last forever? And I think it was, 6 months in that my mum had been trying to send me to see you for a while. And I think she'd called you to say, I'm really worried because I don't, this isn't like her. And I'd been to the doctors and I'd been signed off of work and I'd been diagnosed with clinical depression and I'd been tried on a few different antidepressants. All of them had different, very adverse effects. I didn't sleep for about 4 months. I was like, the insomnia was so unbearable. Shaking, I lost my appetite, my hair started falling out. I mean, it was horrific. And so then my mum just said, you know, this is the last straw, you have to go and see John. I remember coming to see you and the first thing you talked about was, you said, I think you need to go to Calm because it'll be a much faster recovery, a speedier recovery. You said when you're in there, it's like, you know, an incubator that you just, you know, the recovery process is definitely sped up. And I was so terrified of the idea of A, having to be around other people. Like, that was so frightening because I was like, well, I just can't really talk. And things like group therapy, you know, how are you supposed to get through an hour of group therapy was like the most frightening thing I could have ever put myself through. And I came away and thought, no, I'll be fine. I'm not going to do it. And I'm going to be fine on my own. And then I think it was literally a week later that I think I called you and I was just like, I actually can't cope. And I'd been, because it was, I felt like I was in this negative headspace loop. There was nothing. Obviously, I have always had, you know, I think anyone nowadays has to have like their own toolbox of things to, as far as mental health is concerned, to get through the day, right? So I've always written gratitude lists and like gone for long walks with my dog. That gives me a lot of joy. And I, listening to music was a big one for me. But in that burnout period, I couldn't hear music was deafening. It absolutely was so terrifying how much it hurt my ears. So it was like that was taken away. I would actually leave my house once a day to walk the dog. Poor Monty, he was like the only reason why I ever left the house. But I was so terrified of also leaving because I stopped having facial recognition. It was like my brain just shut down. So I stopped having facial recognition. My long-term and short-term memory really diminished. So it was just all of these things that I'd always really relied on, all of my faculties just seemed to have just gone out the window. And so then I went to Calm.
Yeah, we said earlier, didn't we, about talking about rehab, and this is something Finty and I talk about a lot in terms of the stigma. What is rehab? It's one of those weird places. Everyone sits in a circle all day and I don't know, you know, talk about anything from, I don't know, the weather to, I don't know, what shoes they're wearing.
Also either see it in comedy sketches,
yeah.
Or you see it in horror films. You know, there's no happy balance. No. when you the person who hasn't been there, the images that they get shown of it are two such extremes. Mm. And they never get shown the fact that it's actually, I think, one of the kindest environments you can be in. One of the funniest,
yeah.
You know, but also one of the just, it just feels safe and warm and can occasionally feel a little bit sort of high octane, but it's a safe place.
Yeah. Are you okay talking us through that process?
Yeah, of course.
What happened? Because I remember you going and I remember you being there.
You picked me up from the airport and took me in. I remember thinking, what, so you're just going to leave me here now? You're just going to go?
I think you thought I was going to take you to amnesia or something for a dance.
No, I don't think I could.
Yeah, I think that was a bit of a joke.
I thought
you thought we were going to go off clubbing. There's probably a secret part of me thinking that, actually, I've got to be honest. But no.
I know what she needs, a good rave.
Yeah. That's the other therapy we go to when nothing else works. But you were scared, you were frightened, you'd lost all your functions. And just what was that first few days like? Or maybe not just to stick to the first few days, but I think that's the time people worry most. What will I be like? What will the group be like? What will the therapist be like? What's my bedroom even going to be like? And obviously, Ibiza Calm is a particularly special place because it's an old house and stuff. So it lends itself to kind of healing in a way. But what was your experiences? What were they?
Well, so we. Oh, my flight was very delayed. It was one of those things where, you know, like attracts like, and if you're in a really bad state, then obviously your flight's going to be delayed by about 5 hours just waiting at the airport. And so I don't think we got in until the middle of the night. I think you drove me in at about 3 a.m. and I missed the morning, I think it was a Saturday night, so I missed the Sunday meeting and everyone was out at the meeting when I woke up. And so I was quite pleased that the house was pretty much empty. And I was really surprised because it's very beautiful. The house is, you know, again, it lends itself to healing. It's a cozy, gorgeous villa. I was just so frightened for someone to just show up and have to talk to them. And I think one person did stay back and was very chatty and came and had a very big conversation, and I thought, I can actually get through this because I didn't really have to say much. If I just stick near them, I'll be all right. And actually, everyone was just very warm. And I think I spent the first few days just looking at what was right in front of me, you know, looking at my hands, looking at the food that I was eating, looking at the floor. It's a lot of looking down. And, you know, then Sundays are always a very, as I grew very fond of my Sundays at Calm, but I actually, at the beginning, really needed that structure. Mm. So obviously Monday was my big first full day, and yeah, group therapy was terrifying. And I remember just being asked, you know, all you have to do in group therapy is just talk about how you feel, and if you can, if you've got more of your faculties than I did, you can talk about how you're interacting with other people and how they're interacting in front of or with you. And that's very helpful for people. And actually, I learned so many skills that I use in my everyday life now of, you know, one that I always go back to that I think came up in my very first group therapy of, I can't remember who was on that day actually, but anyway, the therapist was said, you know, how do you think people are actually experiencing you, and how are you experiencing other people? Because I don't think it was that thing of, I was so unaware because I was so locked in, my brain was so broken or depressed that I didn't understand anything in that moment. And that idea of actually people experiencing me as vulnerable, or me as, you know, I hadn't really thought about that. I was like, oh God, that's how you're experiencing me. Okay, right. Well, how do I change that? And I think it wasn't until week four that Billy turned around and said, for God's sake, you know, every time I look at you, you just look like this weak, injured bird. You're actually a really powerful woman. Sit up, like, stop letting, you know, people will respond to you the way that you're, the energy that you're putting out. And I was like, oh, okay, sit up, you know, yeah, fold your arms and be pretty tough, because that's what you are. You know, you're still here. You've managed to withstand this. All right, we can move forward. And, you know, the incredible thing that I always say about Calm that really helped me was that amazing structure where you don't have to think about what you're having for breakfast, lunch and dinner. You don't, and the food is amazing and it's really thoughtful. It's really nutritious. You get everything that you need from that. You are doing a lot of emotional work. It's exhausting. You need to have that, you know, that sustenance, that fuel, and that it's lovingly prepared. You know, I'd always visit the kitchen every morning and try and learn a bit of Spanish and you know, but those little moments of your day. And when I had quiet moments, I'd go and visit the chickens, and I learned how to pick up a chicken. And actually, since being at Calm, I don't eat chicken anymore. I can't, because they were a really big part of my recovery.
Which we never killed, by the way. You must say that for the vegans. Yes. We use their eggs, but we don't kill the chickens.
Yeah. Good point. And so then, obviously, you are scheduled in through it, which I think is really important. I think it doesn't give you time to be bored and therefore dangerous in my case. And that you get led, you know, through, literally with your hands held, through this very important recovery process. And it really feels like you're a family in there. And even though I couldn't really speak, I felt so much love for everyone in there. And, you know, there's really important things like, you know, the art therapy. You don't have to, you know, you'd set your intent. We would set our intention at the beginning of each art therapy session once a week. And then you just paint, and then you're not sat there. I mean, of course, if you're going through stuff, I think I was always thinking, like, for God's sake, I just want to be better already. And why is this recovery process taking so long? But actually, now looking back at it, to have that moment where you're just painting and not thinking about anything else, you know, just going for it and trying to be really present, was really powerful. And then the yoga was so powerful, and exercise, actually getting those endorphins going. I was doing kickboxing. By the time I left, I was just beating the crap out of my depression, and it was so powerful. But I think if I had to pick one thing that was the most important, I think, you know, the therapists, all of you guys make it what it is in there. And my one kind of turnaround moment, which I think was kind of week three, because every week I was like, how much longer do I have to be in here? And then I got to a point where I was like, okay, I just don't want to leave, because actually the outside world feels really unsafe.
Yes, I felt exactly the same.
And Uke said to me, you know, you're not going to ever progress and move away from this until you accept where you are. And I realised that my entire life I've been running from where I was and not able to really sit with any emotion. And so I've probably been carrying all of those things. Mm. And as soon as I thought, oh, okay, I'll just sit. I'll just sit in this because it is really dark and it is uncomfortable, but I'm going to sit here because I actually, this is self-inflicted. I put myself through all of this stuff. I didn't, you know, obviously the grief, but I was running away from the grief in a really big way. And it was the first time I had to really experience it and be uncomfortable and sit with it. And as soon as I did that, I think that was when I started to really start stringing sentences for the first time. Which I was delighted about. And that meant that Billy could then turn around and say, hey, stop being so vulnerable. Mm. And then he said, I think you're ready to go home. I was like, huh, what? No, I don't think so. and then I did, and I came home and I didn't really listen to myself. And I got all excited that I could speak again and was very happy, and I did exactly the same thing, and I piled on work and I worked myself into the ground. I think I only came back for, I think I managed 2 months back, and then same thing happened, and I was like, the anxiety was through the roof, and I couldn't cope. I'd signed up to do all of this work that suddenly I was like, I was like, I have to go back to calm. I actually can't cope. I know I have this toolbox, but I haven't listened to any of it, and I can't cope, and I have to go back. And I did, and I actually think I got even more out of my second stint in calm, because I wasn't afraid to be there. I was like desperate to be there. Mm. And the group therapy, I really talked through stuff. I really dealt with some really old issues, old resentments, old anger. I think before my break or burnout, whatever you want to call it, I really struggled with anger. I wasn't safe being angry.
I'm not at all.
No, I'm still find it hugely uncomfortable.
Yeah, me too.
But I think that was a big thing for me, realizing that I'd never really gotten angry ever. And actually, it's a really powerful emotion. Mm. Like the whole spectrum of emotions are important and powerful. And I think I'd suppressed it so much that it all gone inward. And I mean, it wasn't quite probably in as constructive a way as I would have wanted it to, but I definitely got very angry with all the people that I had been angry with for a very long time and never said anything. And for me, that was very important to my full recovery.
Yeah, it's not a neat process, that is it?
No.
You know, let's get in touch with our anger.
No.
You know, as you say, it's almost the opposite pole. You're on a, like some people call it, an exploding doormat, and let everyone walk all over me. But eventually, I'm always angry and aggressive and push people away. And
there's also a similarity between getting well, in inverted commas, and that you don't allow yourself to be angry, because that may be a sign of something that you possibly were before.
Mm. Yes,
so you don't allow yourself to get angry because you don't want to show, like you, I get terribly shaky when I get angry and I cry and I can't articulate properly and my brain goes all messed up and people can run rings around me.
Mm.
And I don't like that feeling. Mm. I don't like that feeling of not being able to articulate.
Mm.
So it's, I think it's a massive one.
Me too. And I think it was, I mean, I think I had to have the initial kind of explosion and a real like pointing fingers of, but yeah. you, and actually it's ridiculous because ultimately that stuff doesn't exist anymore. So I've been holding on to all of this stuff for a really long time, you know, by this point, 29, 30, I mean, I'm now 31, but at that point I was 29 and 29 years. And I actually just had to expel it all. Now, moving forward, what I noticed, I was very proud of myself because I think I'm very good at being the repository position. So I will always apologize, placate. I will always take full responsibility, even though I've done nothing wrong. Yep. It's not my fault. But I'll want to make everything okay. So I'll want to take responsibility because then no one else has to, and then that does it. But then I never thought about how that impacts me. And actually what that does, it means that everyone else thinks it's okay to just dump all their crap on you and make you feel responsible for all of their rubbish. And then you walk around feeling like you're carrying all this crap, but it's not yours. And, well, it was your fault for allowing it in the first place, but it doesn't have to be that way.
When we look at burnout, and again, that's my interpretation of things in terms of perhaps what you've been through, that overwhelming, that idea that you kept saying yes, and as you say, you were on a roll and people wanted you and they needed you almost. To then say no, to stand up for yourself.
So uncomfortable.
So it does fit in. I mean, I have this thing that I worked for a while with people from the city, the traders, and you know, so that was like burnout city.
Yeah, of course.
And you know, the banks would just take what they could, wring every ounce of goodness out of them, and just put them on the scrap heap. And it's often, I mean, I don't know how this will go down when people hear this, but it's the good people get sick. The most conscientious people tend to get sick because they don't always say no.
Yeah.
They want to say yes. Yeah. And there's a whole different side of that, codependency and people pleasing. But actually, in its essence, it comes from a good place. Yeah, I'll do that. Yeah, it's all right that you're a bit late. But actually, what happens to us? Sooner or later, we take on too much. We say yes when we should be saying no. We get resentful. Bang.
But it's also, it's such a side effect of being self-employed. Because you, as you say, you strike while the iron's hot, and you're like, oh, this is amazing. You know, I can do all of this. And I've had maybe 6 weeks before all of this started where I've done nothing.
Yeah.
So I've got all those reserves of energy.
Yeah.
So I can do everything. And you desperately want people to think that you're reliable and kind and on time and funny and prepared and all of
bright.
Those things and really bright and cheerful and a lovely person to have around.
Yeah.
And that in itself is just too much.
It's so exhausting.
It's not real.
Too much.
No, and I think on top of that, there's that. And then I also, one thing that I really struggled with through my burnout was, as well as strike while the iron's hot, I also really love being a really good friend and a good daughter and a good sister. And like, so everyone would always come to me with their stuff, which I actually was always really good at, like, you know, managing things. I'm quite good at giving advice. But when I burnt out, there was I had nothing. And people would tell me their problems, and I'd just be like, that sounds great. Want to swap? You know, I'd give anything to have yours. Can you please have my brain instead?
Yeah.
And I couldn't. But I couldn't even articulate that. But it just, I couldn't, there was no accessing it. And I think it's when you, I think obviously I was just all things to all men.
There's also, I think there's, John and I were talking about it earlier, there's an added thing now about how so many people can have opinions about you on social media. And I think when you say that Strictly was like the best
and the
time
worst.
Of your life.
Yeah.
You suddenly become so open to everybody saying whatever they like about you and whatever paper can publish anything that happened 25 years ago and all of that. And I haven't suffered from exactly the same thing as you, but I suddenly understand that thing about literally losing your voice and losing your ability to speak. Because it seems that every time you say something, when you're in that sort of glare, somebody comments on it, or it's in the paper the next day, or the fact that you went to the shop wearing your pyjamas.
Oh, yeah, there was a lot of that.
I have been known to
I did, yeah, me too.
you know, quite recently.
Good.
But I can see how that can manifest itself in, like, a total shutdown of
well, you're scared
faculty.
To come out, aren't you, literally? You're scared
literally
to give
scared.
An opinion, or you're scared to kind of... Because... It's as you said, it's of your creating, and yet it's not of your creating. Mm. It's the system, or whatever you want to call it. But it's that kind. So how do you cope with that now, bringing it to sort of
post-calm,
what you do for yourself, how do you stay well?
Well, I think it's definitely a daily, I have to work on it daily. I have to have my toolkit at all times, but things like making sure that I'm not put in that repository position is a really big one. I'm a big fan of meditation. I'm a big fan of now every morning I do just three things I'm grateful for, and then three things that I'm, you know, are my intentions for the day. So even if I've woken up a bit groggy or whatever, had a bad dream or haven't slept that well, it then at least steers me in a much more positive direction. Mm. I have a very, through being really unwell, I have a very incredible, very tight-knit, small support network that are all hilarious. Right. And, you know, good laugh, really cozy. I can be completely real with, I can, you know, show up with no makeup and spot cream and a tracksuit, and I won't be judged at all. I'll be welcomed with open arms. Making sure that I don't ever isolate again. I think that was a big one for me. That, you know, never allowing myself to get to a place where I can even do that. So
when John and I came up with this idea for this podcast, we came up with a list of people who we wanted to interview, and we reached out to a lot of them. And the people that responded were men. About 70%. Really? And I think that as a woman, I'm not saying it's a much bigger thing, but I think it takes a certain level of bravery to talk about it, because I think we're not sometimes allowed to express quite how we're feeling. Mm. And I'm just really, really grateful that you came along.
Oh, thank you. That
thank
means so
you
much.
So much.
No, it's my pleasure. I know that without talking about this stuff, there is so much stigma attached to it, and it's so heartbreaking, because actually I don't know anyone that doesn't struggle with their mental health, and be it addiction, burnout, depression, any, you know, across the board, everyone experiences it. I mean, whether they like to admit it is a different thing. Yeah. But, you know, people knowing about Ibiza Calm, you know, the fact that you guys exist is... you know, a godsend. Absolutely. Like, I really genuinely don't think I'd be here without actually you forcing me on that plane.
Yeah, yeah. I wouldn't be here without John McKeown.
Yeah.
Well,
and my mum feels
enough.
The same about him.
So does mine. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
John, thank you for being amazing,
thank
as always.
Thank you for being amazing, as usual.
If you've enjoyed listening to us today, please subscribe. And if you really feel like it, you could give us a 5-star review, which would be amazing. And we'd be very, very grateful. Until next week, goodbye.